From Vermont Public Radio, this is the podcast of Switchboard, a public affairs call-in program. Switchboard is produced by Vermont Public Radio and webcast at vpr.net. This podcast is made possible by VPR and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a contributing member at vpr.net.
Good evening and welcome to Switchboard. I'm Fran Stoddard. In the last hour, we heard a talk by Jan Albers and Darby Bradley on the past and future of the Vermont landscape. Their presentation is a part of the George D. Aiken Lecture Series at the University of Vermont, and this program is made possible by a grant from the Lintelak Foundation. And we're interested in your thoughts and reactions to the points they made in their address. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211, that toll-free number made possible by Sovereignet. When you think of Vermont, how important is the landscape in that image? Do you think that preserving our landscape comes at a price? Is our connection to the land different here in Vermont than in other parts of the country? We want to hear your thoughts on the lecture we just heard. Call us at 1-800-639-2211. My guests for this conversation in the studio are Robert McCulloch and Paul Bierman. Robert McCulloch has a law degree with a doctorate in city and regional planning and a specialty in historic preservation. Welcome to Switchboard.
Thank you.
And Paul Bierman is a geologist and professor at the University of Vermont who oversees the Landscape Change Program and numerous projects on erosion around the world. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Good evening.
I thought I'd start with one of the many points that Jan Albers made. She talks about Vermont being small, but a place that's imbued with a strong sense of being special, and that our exceptionalism is kind of based on two things, the belief that Vermonters have retained more of their crotchety independence, and secondly, that our pride, about our pride in having preserved the landscape of exceptional beauty. What's your reaction to that? I mean, is that what we're about, that crotchety independence and the beauty of the landscape, Bob?
Well, certainly some of it. I think that also the sense of egalitarianism that Darby mentioned is also important and very much part of the Vermont experience and the balance between community interest and private interest seems to be important as well.
Mm, that the freedom and unity
yes.
that he brought up. And Paul, your thoughts?
Oh, I think it's a very intriguing landscape. It's also an extremely varied landscape from the point of view of somebody who has spent his life and with his students looking at this landscape. We go from the steep mountains and essentially alpine tundra down to the lake and a much warmer environment, much more hospitable environment. So I think that change in physical environment has really also helped shape the cultural changes in the state as you go from place to place.
Hmm. I was also struck that she claimed that poverty was our preservative, even when and even that we rely on poverty to preserve the landscape. Can we still do that?
I thought that was the most fascinating piece of Jan's talk. I really enjoyed that, and it really opened up, I think, a lot of vistas for me in terms of looking at the landscape and thinking, wow, these things are still here because nobody had the money to change them. And I think it's a remarkable view on preservation, if not by intent, then really by accident because of that.
Right. It forces us to move slowly and make changes in a considered way.
But can we do that? It seems that we are changing very quickly.
It's the problem. How do we address that problem, I think, is the key issue.
I think it's also was striking to me around that, that these beautiful civic and residential buildings built at the end of the 19th century that towns love and that reveal this civic pride were not based on the bottom line. And I'm just wondering, how do we regain that civic pride that creates beautiful architecture and beautiful buildings that we want to keep for a long time?
Again, I suppose a question of trying to strike a balance in the decisions that we make and find a way to accommodate private interest and public good at the same time. And one of the things we do in our classes is to try to get students to read history in the landscape and interpret that landscape and look for ways where that balance exists. And we call that community, but we can use that term loosely and look for ways where that balance is somehow visible.
We have some calls. We'll get to them. Bill from Hardwick has called in. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I'd like to make a comment and then leave it to folks in your panel there to comment on it. One thing is I would agree with that our landscape and our way of life seems to be more and more falling in line with what you see in Connecticut and New Jersey. We seem to be losing something. Now, what I'd like the folks to comment on, now, they're getting a lot of press lately, this group, the Second Vermont Republic, who is trying to return Vermont to a democratic republic like it was back with the days of Ethan Allen and Governor Chittenden. I was wondering if they think that's a viable option and what folks should do to make that happen if they do. And I'll turn it over to you all now. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I guess I can start as a geologist that's about as far away from what I think about day to day in terms of being a democratic republic. But I think the ideals of in a sense, self-control and self-government are very close to the state. It's one of the things that drew me here. I have been here for 13 years now, and it's a place I think I'll never leave. But the idea that we control our own destiny, be it the landscape destiny, be it the building destiny, is, I think, really important. And to me, personally, that's where I think it's important for us to concentrate, whether it's in the current form of government or another, the idea that we're controlling our own landscape.
Yes, I think that's true. And I also, one of the points that Jan made is good, that the evidence of what we see around us in the landscape represents the decisions we make, the choices we make, and how we decide to use land. And it's a very visible very visible thing to be able to recognize.
But even it was very limited in the 1700s. It was kind of this land-grabbing free-for-all. Mm-hmm. Back in that time, we were the wilderness, which is also interesting for New England and the rest of the country at that time. How did that time, when this was a wilderness and not about the tight communities of the rest of New England, influence what we are? And it's really the landscape influenced us, it seems, rather than vice versa at first.
Certainly that's true for the natural landscape. There's very little left of the cultural landscape from that early period where Vermont was just being settled. But I think that some of that, some of those natural landscapes are still very much with us. The forested hillsides, for example, that have come back in recent years.
Right. And speaking of what 70% was deforested, which is, it's back to the opposite when the sheep were so popular. We made some bad choices about how to use the land in a way in the early 1800s as well, and that allowed for soil erosion, et cetera. Paul, have we learned that lesson, and do people understand more about sustaining land?
Well, I think I'd step back a bit and say we have to look at the context of when these different events happened in the past. And so today we have the luxury and I think the somewhat short view that Vermont is the Green Mountain State and our forests cloak the hill slopes. And we argue over whether or not there should be wind towers and how much clear cutting we should be doing. But 150 years ago, that wasn't even an argument when 70 to 80% of the landscape was cleared. And that clearance was by necessity for the economy, for people to have firewood, for transportation. So in a sense, we sit in a position where we can make perhaps more choices now rather than fewer choices because we're less dependent on that landscape directly for our day-to-day activities.
Hmm. Steve has called in from Moscow. Welcome to the show, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey. Hi, Fran. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to address this issue of cultural heritage a little bit. My family came up here in the 1790s and has lived here ever since. And I'll tell you, with family stories and family history and people who knew people who were related to people who actually saw the kinds of things that we were talking about or heard about today, that cultural history is alive and very, very real. It's not completely lost. It's there if you go to find it. The reason I called was I wanted to pick up on a point that we heard before the program began. Part of making Vermont a community in which people can live as a community is to allow people to make their livings and earn their livings in the Vermont countryside itself. Not everybody should be commuting to work in a in the city or the town. We all can agree that logging and farming are good and good for the community, but these are not museum activities. They're very real, and they're kind of messy. So what I think we need to keep in mind is it can't be like, the Billings Farm or something like that, where, it's almost a museum. If it's going to be real and really a part of the community, people will have to tolerate noise and mud and, the things that go along with logging and with farming. So that's the point I wanted to make. I don't think we want to lose track of that.
Thank you, Steve. I think you're absolutely right, and I'd love the comment here. But I also, how would you define the cultural history that you were talking about earlier?
Well, when I look around the state, I'm looking at land that people that I'm related to looked at and farmed and walked on and traveled across. And many places, I can tell, they told me stories about, who used to live here, or the land that looks wooded and wild was heavily settled. You walk around in the woods and, everybody sees this, but I don't know if you really think about it. There are old roads up there and cellar holes and old posts, and everywhere you go you see really almost up to the tippity top of these hills and mountains.
There's stories and life there.
You see mm-hmm. stone walls. I mean, people lived there. Now it's all woods again, but this was all settled land once.
Thank you, Steve. So some thoughts about that older reality and the real reality of farming and logging today.
I think Steve made just a fantastic point there. And certainly coming at this from a geologist who's looked at 15,000 years of history in Vermont, and especially concentrated on the last several hundred, as the geologic record records it. The arrival of Western settlers here completely upset this landscape in terms of sediment pouring off hill slopes and into rivers, and the shapes and sizes of river channels changing, and the sediment pouring into Lake Champlain. And we've essentially run a huge experiment on this entire Vermont landscape of what happens when you take the trees off and have very intensive agriculture, and then let it go back. And the talks before really talked about that going back and the cycle of poverty and abandonment and reforestation. I think the place we're at now is a really interesting one, because we know what happens when there's very little control on landscape change and landscape development. But in that last 100 years, as scientists, we've learned an awful lot about how one can simultaneously use the land, Darby's view of rural areas as production areas, and at the same time maintain all the things that I think we all believe in are important here, and clean water and good fisheries and streams and healthy ecosystems. I think there are ways to do those hand in hand with good management and careful planning.
I would agree, too. And I think sometimes we wind up focusing so much on aesthetics that we overlook a lot of the diversity and richness in that diversity that makes our landscapes interesting. And if we can somehow get past that barrier of aesthetics, we begin to explore all of these stories that exist in our cultural landscapes, whether it's the cellar holes up on the mountaintops or various types of industry that still exist or exist in terms of archaeological evidence.
I thought it was interesting when Darby was really struck by this quote from, I believe it was the head of the Maine Planning Office, that rural communities are organized for production and suburban communities are organized for consumption. And it seems that a lot of the struggle is between those two things.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just getting a lot of nods, but
yes.
Is it any other?
It's the conversion of farmland in Williston to Walmarts. That's production to consumption.
Mm-hmm. And is that a cautionary tale? Vermonters are also looking for inexpensive goods. They're looking for economic security on some level. So there's this constant tension between community and development, et cetera. How can we really watch our step and feel we're making the right ones?
Well, one of the things that Darby mentioned at the very end in looking for ways to address some of these problems was the need to make decisions or to consider the decision-making process as part of a community context. and to weigh the benefits to individuals against the larger benefits to the community. And if we make decisions that are primarily aimed at individual benefit, in the end, we're going to lose because the community is going to deteriorate. And so it's important to use the community context as a backdrop to the decision making we do.
We're talking to Robert McCullough, who teaches at the University of Vermont Historic Preservation and Regional and City Planning, and Paul Bierman, a geologist and also a professor at the University of Vermont. We hope that you join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Bob from Rutland Town has called in. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there?
Yes, good evening.
Hi,
good evening.
Welcome to Switchboard.
Well, thank you very much. Just wanted to ask your panel what their thoughts were about, I know in our area, in Rutland, along the beautiful Otter Creek, as I'll refer to it, and so they're hoping to take that area, which, again, using the word productive, has been a very productive, you know, along that river land, along that area, and they're going to try to use it to develop a new rail yard by using something you're probably all familiar with. Communities are using what's called eminent domain, obviously, to take away a lot of the land, and that's a good deal of land that's taken. Is that a real great threat to Vermont, as much as I see some people seeing it is? Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Bob, I'm going to go to you, our legal expert.
Well, the whole question of eminent domain has been in the news lately, and the ability of governments to acquire private property for public purpose after having paid compensation has been a very important part of our legal history, and it still exists. And the current cases are asking whether or not that public purpose extends as far as acquiring private land and then turning that same private land over to other private developers in order to somehow improve local economies. And that's a difficult issue. I think that the whole question of just what constitutes a public purpose lies at the heart of that. And I had sort of hoped that the Supreme Court would have focused a little bit more on that and wondered why the criteria for determining public purpose weren't introduced in some of the recent cases that were just decided. So I would hope that it wouldn't, that sort of thing wouldn't become an issue here, but it's a formal part of American law at the moment.
Okay, interesting question, Bob. Thank you for bringing that up. Obviously, we'll continue to look at that. Duncan has called in from Fairfield. Hi, Duncan. Welcome to Switchboard.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to try and emphasize a point that Darby made, which was just made again recently. I'm a sixth-generation Vermonter over the age of 50, and just in my lifetime have seen huge differences in the fabrics of our communities. When I was growing up, the community I lived in, we made things. We had sawmills and lumber mills and harness makers, and a lot of that has disappeared. We seem to be homogenizing into this great globalization concept where my fears we're going to end up being a place where we don't make anything or produce anything anymore, and I think that's a great tragedy. I think the point that Darby made with regard to the decisions that we make at the community level, both as individuals and as communities, is very, very important, and we need to try and make those, you know, look beyond being able to buy cheap plastic crap from China, excuse the phrase, and look beyond that and think of ways that we can support our communities. The other point I wanted to make or story I wanted to tell, I work for the town and village of Johnson, who was able to take advantage of two incidents to create new public buildings that are beautiful buildings. They match the architecture of the village. One was a flood event where the town offices were damaged, and out of that tragedy, the community got together and designed and built a wonderful new municipal building. And 2 years ago, there was a tragic fire at the fire station adjacent to the municipal office. And out of that tragedy, the Board of Trustees used a great deal of foresight and designed a beautiful building to complement both the municipal building and the downtown. So I think if we're creative and thoughtful, you know, we can sometimes take advantage of opportunities that, you know, will enable us to continue that, you know, cultural aspect of our villages.
Thank you so much, Duncan. I think just to back up what you're saying, one of the things that Darby talked about in talking about the importance of community was, he said, a strong economy is essential to a strong community, but not an end in itself. We should accept aspects of globalization and economic benefit that strengthen our community, but resist those that do not. So this is, again, a matter of choice, the choices that we make. Any thoughts about how do we make the right choice? It clearly, Duncan feels that Johnson made the right choice with the rebuilding of those two buildings in that particular town.
Well, the process is can be a long one, and design solutions, as you point out, offer a lot of opportunities. And I think that if we can engage the public, or get, I should say, help the public become more engaged in developing good design for buildings, we can address many of those issues. So design, architecture, landscape architecture can play an important role in any decision-making process.
And can globalization somehow fit into our economy?
I don't know about globalization, but I was going to respond to what Bob had said. And first to say that I completely agree with Duncan that I think the onus is on us to design those buildings that fit both the landscape, cultural landscape and natural landscape. But one of the ways that Bob and I have worked together in the past is with an archive of imagery that we host at the University of Vermont, about 13,000 images of Vermont as it used to be and as it is today. And I think one of my strongest motivations for keeping that archive going is that it gives us a glimpse into 120 years of the past. And it really lets us look at what villages have looked like in the past and what rural areas have looked like. And my hope is that it will be used by planners and by people in Vermont to say, this is what it could be, this is what it used to be, and maybe this is what it'll be in the future. It provides that essentially visual database.
How do people find that Changing Landscape project?
Ah, okay. Go onto the web and look for uvm.edu/Perkins/landscape. Or go to Google and type landscape change program.
Perfect. That's what I do. David has called in from Greensboro. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Well, I'm concerned about the buildings, which have always made up the Vermont cultural landscape. We're losing our small farms. We're losing those farmhouses and the barns. Sometimes larger farms combine into larger buildings, and that's fine, but small farmhouses and small barns get left behind, and they're crumbling into the ground. And the second problem we have is that of people building houses that are too large, new houses that are too large for our landscape. Canadians coming down and building these houses along the shores of Champlain. We have a Florida real estate developer that's just bought Berkski Mountain, and their history has been making money with million-dollar houses. And so I suggest that we take, oh, let's say the first 2,500 square feet of those houses and tax them at the usual rate for the town, and then take the excess footage and tax it at a higher rate and put that money into a trust fund that people can draw from to resupport these old farmhouses and these old barns. Problem is, not that people don't want them, but that they can't afford to keep them up. So let's use the money from the McMansions to resupport our small farm heritage in the state as best we can.
That's an interesting solution, David. Thank you for that thought. What about second home owners and what they contribute or might not be contributing to the state? Bob?
Well,
none of these are easy questions,
no,
are they?
No, they're all complicated, and there aren't any good easy answers. I suppose, once again, the comment that Darby made at the very end, we have to make decisions that are framed in a community context. And if that means encouraging people who are second home owners to participate in those decisions and recognize the need for a backdrop of community context, then maybe that is a good idea.
Is there a way that we can engage second homeowners if that's how a town wants to go?
Again, this is way out of my expertise, but my suspicion is that many of those second homeowners are here for what we value about this landscape, the openness, the fields, the forest, the views. And that may not translate into the type of home that's built, but I'm suspecting that's part of their aesthetic for being here. And so it seems like there's a path into including those people in this process. Strikes me also that towns need zoning. They need ways in which to formalize this, formalize their strongly held aesthetic beliefs so that they can be turned into landscape preservation on the ground.
Okay. Francois from South Londonderry has called in. Welcome to the show, Francois.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Is this Fran?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, like Francois, which is my name.
It's a lovely name, isn't it?
I have more of a statement than a question, but it could be a question, too.
Great.
As I said to you, I believe that the Vermont Land Trust should be the state's foremost protector of Vermont's unique scenic landscapes, and it should take a stand now before it's too late against the permanent destruction of Glebe Mountain, which is my interest here because we're right near it, and the future sites in the state that may be designated for construction of wind generators sometime in the future. So that's more or less a statement. I'd like to have someone comment on that, whether the land trust can in fact be our protector of our scenic values.
Bob, do you have a sense of that? I mean, certainly there's how much money do they have? There are limitations here.
I think, yes, there are limitations, and I think that large wind farm projects such as that on Glebe Mountain are going to require more participants than just the land trust. Those are very complex issues, and the land trust can certainly help and participate, but there are regulatory systems that are established in Vermont that are available to try to address the many concerns that surround whole questions of wind power and wind turbines that are being constructed.
Well, I imagine that the Land Trust has played a role certainly in the preservation of the landscape to some degree. Are you up on what they're trying to do?
Yes, I think Darby gave some specifics on that, and they have conserved a substantial amount of land, and they are doing all the right things. But some of these issues are just too large to be addressed by any one organization.
So our communities have to get involved as well.
Yes.
This is Switchboard on Vermont Public Radio.
Tonight on Switchboard, a discussion about the history and future of Vermont's landscape. Fran Stoddard's guests are historic preservation expert Bob McCulloch and geologist Paul Bierman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. The VPR website has audio of past Switchboard programs, VPR news, and commentaries. Just go to vpr.net. Support for VPR comes from our contributing listeners and Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, where nurses are transforming medicine every day. Information online at dhmc.org. And the Vermont Community Foundation, a partner for Vermont nonprofit organizations offering endowment management and planned giving services, vermontcf.org. Switchboard continues with host Fran Stoddard.
We are talking about the changing landscape of Vermont. One of the things that Darby suggested is that we create density in town centers now while we have the chance, he was kind of saying. Paul, you had your study on green space loss in Burlington, so you're kind of aware of town density. And I'm sure, Bob, you are on a whole historic preservation piece. Let's start with you, Bob.
Yes, I think it's one of the key pieces to the puzzle. And we've been focusing on ways to increase density in urban centers to protect traditional growth patterns. That was one of the points that Darby made too, and to look for ways to introduce that density without disrupting neighborhood fabric. And again, design, architecture can offer some solutions. And there are a number of innovative examples around the world where urban densities have been increased successfully, all the while preserving open space and community structure, infrastructure, transportation systems, and pedestrian walkways and access to schools. All of those things have to be considered as part of the increased urban density objectives.
And Paul, I'm interested in your response, because you were concerned about the loss of green space, I think, to automobile parking from,
sure,
from your students did this interesting study.
Yeah, no, it's work that students mostly in the geology department have done over the last half a decade in Burlington, looking at the unpermitted and unplanned change of land use from residential neighborhoods with 50 to 60% green space and lawns to the same residential neighborhoods where houses are split up into three or four apartments, and you go from having two cars to having eight cars on the property, and the only place to put them seems to be the lawn. I'm actually an advocate for much higher density development in cities, but I think that density has to be done smartly, and it has to be done in a coherent, planned fashion. And I think it gives you the benefits, once you've done it, of certainly reduced energy use, the ability to actually have mass transit and make it economical, and I think also to have somewhat technologically sophisticated environmental solutions, so that you can say, if we have enough people, then we can afford to have parking garages with green roofs, or we can afford to do other things that, when the development is sort of haphazard and here or there, never happen. And the other thing is, in cities, you actually have the ability and the infrastructure there to deal with stormwater and things like that when it's planned and it's worked ahead. So I think this all is coming back to kind of smart growth and growth that's been thought through and is consistent with the community's vision.
Okay. Judy is with us from Fayston. Welcome to Switchboard, Judy.
Yes. Hello, Fran and others. This is the fourth formerly rural area where I've lived and grew up, where farmland and mountainsides are taken over by large or huge houses. I don't even want to go back and see where I grew up. And in a way, I don't have to, because it's here. And what if people love the landscape, I don't know why they build on the mountains and then clear in front of them. And the point that was just made, towns where I grew up, well, I grew up outside of them, people lived in apartments in the town, over the stores, and the real life was in the towns, which people have been talking about now a little bit, but probably in a different way. I see vacant-looking windows instead of apartments in places like Montpelier and other, not small in Vermont ways, but I think you get my point.
Yes, thank you very much, Judy. It takes me to the landscape reflects our values. And do we want to live alone on a hillside in our big, huge house or in the community? So the landscape certainly speaks to our values at any given time, Bob.
Sure. The landscape is a mirror, giving our society its most vivid reflection. And I agree completely that it's sad to see existing village centers. Montpelier is a perfect example where storefronts or upstairs, second and third stories are vacant, and instead new buildings are being built in outer regions, and there just doesn't seem to be an efficient or a logical way to reverse that trend. Or I should say, that whole trend doesn't seem logical, and I think that there should be a way to reverse that trend.
Thoughts, Paul? Not really. Okay.
No,
I think that's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Burlington has a very vibrant downtown, and you walk down Church Street and look up, and you see apartments, and you see people in them, and you see laundry hanging out the back. And it's an exciting town to live in, I think, partially for that reason.
And also, historically in Vermont, people want to go out into the wilderness and have their own place. So there's that historic piece there.
That's not just Vermont. I mean, that's the sort of ex-urban trend around this whole country of build big houses on big lots. It's the 10-acre zoning.
Nirmec has called in from Huntington Center. Hi, Nirmec. Welcome to Switchboard.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great.
Thanks for the program. It's been great. I guess I just have a statement. I want to just thank Vermont for being the way it is. I've been fortunate to grow up here, work in probably 30, 40 different towns in the state of Vermont. I can't tell you how much it shaped me, how I feel inside when, you know, I come back from being in another state. It is my culture, and it's so rich. This is a tremendous, rich culture here, whether you're in the skiing or you worked on farms or you worked in the woods. It permeates everything. And another thing that should be mentioned is the weather. The weather is very strong. It's very dynamic. And it also, you know, it fits right in with this, the rugged mountains and the hills and the valleys and the lake.
Sure. I think actually, Paul, you also had a paper on clear cuts and big storms.
Oh, yeah. No.
So
I mean,
how has the weather shaped us and who we are?
I think the weather shaped us and it shaped this landscape dramatically. The big storms paper is looking back over 14,000 years of really big storms in Vermont. And we tend to look at the 27 flood as our really big storm. And if you look in the image archive, you'll find several hundred images of the 27 flood. And it's defining, I guess, well, Bob can follow on this. It's defining architecturally for bridges, certainly, because so many of them disappeared in that flood. But I think the weather certainly shapes how we interact with our landscape. And just look at this winter. This is a winter without snow. And you can't talk to anybody and not hear about, is this global climate change? What's happening? Is this going to be Vermont in the future? It's probably just a blip, but it may be what global climate change looks like in 20 or 30 or 40 years here. And it could, I think, fundamentally change how we view our state if we don't have winters with snow on the ground.
Nirmec also brings up a really good point about how so many of us feel when we return to this state and how precious and different it is. And Darby asked the question, what is the degree of the threat? He thought it was great. Your thoughts on the degree of threat, Bob?
I would agree, too. And his comment, I thought, was very to the point. We may not have as much time as we think we have to try to correct the problems that need to be addressed.
Okay, we're talking about the changing landscape. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Sandy from South Londonderry, another South Londonderry person has called in. Go ahead, Sandy.
I've enjoyed the program very much, and I just want to say that I have lived on this property for 21 years and have learned a great deal from the land. And because we are one of the towns of about 8 towns in the state that are discussing the industrial scale wind on our mountains, it's been quite a divisive subject in the community. And community is important, and we are an important community to try to hold things together. And I think everybody really is trying to do the right thing. But in terms of looking at the future and the landscape future for this state, I think that allowing developers to decide some of our future landscape needs and to do that is a little bit backwards. I think that the state and the communities should decide how they envision the future and should be very much involved in that process and not just have to do it in a defensive manner. I also think that Act 250 is an important thing, and Act 248 is also important in terms of deciding electric policy. But I don't think that when these two do have some conflicts, and because these projects now are so huge, the one in Glebe Mountain is talking about 19 420-foot-tall flashing-lighted turbines. So it's a very complicated subject, and we need some real policy decisions on if we're going to do this, where are we going to put it, and where is most appropriate for these things to go.
And I would imagine you also have land around ski areas that have changed quite a bit.
Right, and I think that there's another whole issue in terms of the ski areas. This would be put in part right next on top of a ski area, and then the question would be, is this a safe location for people to actually have winter sports? I mean, would this potentially shut down the mountain because most of these other facilities are fenced off.
Thank you, Sandy. Paul, your thoughts about, now we're talking energy here and the land.
In terms of divisive issues, I guess I could say this is the one that most divides myself, because I deal every day in my teaching and work with my students about energy, about climate. As I say, we look back 14,000 years in climate, and the climate changes in Vermont have been dramatic over that period. And I look at all the scientific work that's gone into global climate change, and there's just no uncertainty left that we are running a huge global experiment right now and that the outcome of that experiment is going to be a warmer climate. We may not know how much warmer, we may not know how much stormier, but there are going to be very large-scale changes, probably within our lifetimes and certainly within our children's lifetimes. So that forces me to make this balance, which I'm very uncomfortable with, about these dramatic landscape changes versus what can we do to reduce our dependence on non-renewable resources, a carbon-based economy. I think that Darby hit it right, and it was one of the most articulate expressions I've heard about how to deal with the wind, which is it's a scale issue. And can we do this in a way where we can generate perhaps not quite as much energy, perhaps with quite not the profit margins, but we can start reducing our fossil fuel dependence? There will be landscape impacts. But again, working through this historic archive, there have been huge changes on this landscape in the past. And so I guess that has sobered me a bit to the fact that the landscape actually never looks quite the same through time. And I'm willing to personally accept some amount of change in exchange for maybe not having winters like this 30 or 40 years from now, you know, so I can play with my grandchildren in the snow. It's a really, really difficult decision for me.
Okay,
I would agree too, and I think scale is the focus point for the immediate concern. And somehow, if we need to reach a consensus if we can, and make decisions about projects such as the Glebe Mountain project, and scale is key. There are also other factors. In fact, we've just finished a segment in my History on the Land class where we've talked about the history of wind power and windmills, and Vermont has played an important role in some of that technology. And here again, there may be more than just aesthetics at issue. There are stories to tell in the development of this wind technology, and some think the wind turbines are beautiful. That's the kind of debate that goes on in our class, and it's people's individual ideas about beauty and aesthetics are going to vary substantially. And so this is one of the areas where it's really hard to find community consensus. And we just have to continue engaging participants in the community and trying to reach decisions and move forward.
We're talking to Robert McCullough, who teaches historic preservation at the University of Vermont, and Paul Bierman, a geologist and also a professor at UVM. We're talking in reference to Jan Albers and Darby Bradley's talk that was recorded earlier this evening. We have Gregory from Mooresville has called in. Go ahead, Gregory.
Yeah, good evening. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I can't thank you enough for this this public forum. It's a great place for Vermonters to talk about important things. I'm a fourth generation Vermont, I don't know, fourth and fifth, or depending on how you measure, a woodcutter from Vermont. And I sort of want to talk about how important it is for us to use our renewable resources, wood, of course, wood, wind being another, and water, of course. It's been recently public that, blatantly public that the wood chips are a great source of energy to heat large public institutions. Thing about cutting wood in Vermont is people go to work, and it's really important for us to burn our wood as a renewable resource. I think not on a stupid scale, not on a large scale. We're smart enough now that we can be good about it. 70% of Vermont is wooded. Did I hear that number?
Yes.
Earlier, and that's a really important resource, I think, for us to use here in Vermont. Stacking wood, we all know because of Vermont, it
keeps us warm a couple times.
A really intimate bond with the land, and when you burn that wood to keep you warm in the winter, it really makes you appreciate what the earth is and what the land in Vermont here to us. So I guess my question would be, how much aesthetic or how much of that do we give up in order to preserve our own lifestyle, you know, to preserve ourselves with a renewable resource?
Good question, Gregory. Thank you for calling in. Paul?
I think this talks directly to scale, actually, and the idea of renewable energy. Certainly, we burn wood occasionally. I completely agree with you about the connection. If I've spent a whole afternoon splitting wood and then it's going in the fire, it means a whole lot more than turning up the thermostat. But I think it's also an important way to look at the future in terms of our energy use. It's going to be a mixed bag of energy use. We're not going to get rid of petroleum completely. But if this is a way to start weaning us off the non-renewable resources, I think it's great. I'm fully believe that we can have working, productive landscapes that include harvesting timber. We just need to do it smart. We need to do it in a way that doesn't impact the stream channels, doesn't impact the hill slopes severely. Yeah, it makes a mess, but if that mess is done correctly, it's done seasonally, it's done in a reasonable fashion, I think you can coexist with the 70% forest, some of which is rotationally logged for various uses, and we can all be fine that way.
Dan has called in from Chittenden. Hi, Dan, and welcome to Switchboard.
Hi. Thank you for having this forum. You folks are covering a lot of territory here. My questions changed a couple of times just listening. my basic question is, what can we do to help a sustainable agriculture? I think our main source of energy on this planet is the sun, and that fossil fuel is actually the alternative. So I don't buy calling solar energy or wind energy the alternative. I think it's a bill of goods that's been sold to us by corporate conglomerates. But let's not go there. But I guess my main thing is that there's a lot of land out there, a lot of old farms, beautiful old places that are being bought as trophy homes and turned into trophy homes, and basically the land is being neglected or broken off into lots and sold when there are hundreds of people. Traditionally, the land has been the way to feed families, and now it's being removed from agriculture altogether. And I'm just concerned, and I'm trying to figure out, what can we do? I mean, I'm trying to learn as much as I can about it, but it's a wily one.
Yes, thank you, Dan. Clearly, he brings up the issue of second homeowners again, who come here because they want something that they find is special, but are they putting it at risk? Bob, your thoughts on this, again, development versus preservation?
Boy. I guess I would go back to the idea that we've been sort of carrying forward in these last few calls, that a working landscape is a richer landscape. And every time we allow change to erode portions of that working landscape, then our landscape becomes a little more sterile, whether it's second homes, depletion of forests, lack of agriculture. And each of these little pieces helps to make our landscapes more sustainable, more variable, and richer. And also in terms of cultural history, all the stories that the landscapes hold become more readable. And so we just have to somehow make people aware of all of those very subtle sometimes considerations when we make decisions about how our land is going to be used.
What about the role of agriculture in our landscape? We are losing farms on a very regular basis.
Well, I actually see an interesting connection between this call and the call that opened the program in terms of being local. And that if we are buying local products, be they wood that was milled 10 miles away and cut locally, or local strawberries or local cheese or local milk, we're sustaining that productive landscape in various ways. And to me, this is all about, again, it's coming back to energy, in the sense that if we can afford to bring in lettuce and cabbages from California because that's cheaper, or we insist on eating that in the middle of winter rather than eating local food and locally grown products, that's the crux of this. And so as long as we have relatively, in terms of the world's view, low energy costs and we can afford to do that, this will continue. But one of the concerns that we talked about with one of Bob's colleagues was, what happens if gasoline is $7 or $8 or $9 a gallon? Do we have enough farmland left in Vermont to grow our own food at that point? That's a really interesting question.
That is an interesting question, especially when there's this tendency to to move out into, if there's space, we want to move into it. Isn't that a natural reaction, at least for Americans?
To some extent, although lately I've been growing more fond of denser urban environments, and I discovered that it's much less efficient to have all that extra space. And I like to be able to walk where I need to go. And whatever desire I had for extra space seems to have vanished in the last couple of years.
So your values are changing.
Yes.
That might be happening. Nancy's called in from Burlington. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. It could also be you don't want to cut the grass anymore.
This is true, Nancy. Yes.
There's just so much to talk about, and so many people have said a lot of fantastic things. And clearly the word scale keeps coming back, and the word density. And I have to say that having purchased conservation land in the great southern state of Massachusetts for a few decades or so, that my perspective here in Vermont is that it is a matter of density, that even in areas where we have, for example, the little town of Worcester, Vermont, which doesn't exactly have a large urban, you know, center, and you'd be hard-pressed to think about packing a lot of more houses in there because it just wouldn't look the same at all because it's not highly dense. But along all the roads, you know, all the frontage is being developed, and it was a lot of it was developed during the 10-acre phase. And in a way, that's good. And what makes that town really still nice and lovely and low density is mostly because behind those houses, there's nothing. And that's really important. And that brings me to the question of, well, the one person we haven't mentioned on this program yet, I don't think, is the landowner. The landowner is really the key to all of this. You know, they're the ones who are going to sell the land. They're the ones who are going to make the decision in every community what really happens to that community. And clearly there are things we can do to, you know, make their decision more prone to what we'd like them to make it. But I do want to make a pitch that despite the wonderful work of the Vermont Land Trust, and clearly they've done an incredible job, it's important that we start thinking about local land trust, people who know the people. You know, they say politics is personal, land is personal. And so I highly recommend that more communities form their own local land trust to work with the state and the land and the large land trust. But one last thing about density in cities. Is there a connection between the development of a city, and I'm not just talking about Burlington, but any city, and the lack of development outside of that city? Now, I'll just mention Oregon. I know that'll ring some bells, and I'll let you guys talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Nancy. She certainly brings up things about landowners and the community say about what a landowner might do with his or her land. Mm-hmm. Interesting concept.
Right. Yes, I think there are very close connections between the development of land in a city and the development or growth of or retention of open space in lands surrounding the city. The two are very, very closely connected. And the idea of increasing urban density is a response to concerns about sprawl, which creates so many economic and other types of inefficiencies. So yes, I think the two are intimately connected.
Paul, last quick thought. Okay. Robert, Paul Berman, a geologist and a professor at UVM, thank you so much for being in here tonight. And Robert McCullough, I want to thank you for joining us. He's an attorney and a professor of historic preservation at the University of Vermont. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next Tuesday on Switchboard, we'll talk to the new Adjutant General of Vermont, freshly chosen that day by the legislature. NPR News is next, followed by Jazz with George Thomas. The producer of Switchboard is Patty Daniels. The director is Neil Charnoff. We've had production assistance from Melody Baudet. I'm Fran Stoddard. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks to all the callers that have called in, and have a good evening.
Funding for Switchboard is provided by a grant from the Lintelak Foundation, promoting research, education, and sound environmental policy for Vermont since 1975. For a CD of tonight's program, send $12 to Vermont Public Radio,
365 Troy Avenue, Colchester, Vermont, 05446. That's VPR 365 Troy Avenue, Colchester, Vermont, 05446. Please include the date and subject of tonight's program.
Thanks for checking out this edition of Switchboard from Vermont Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by VPR and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a contributing member at vpr.net.